Hello everybody, welcome to this presentation about keeping the past and preserving the future for the Iraco programming language. I hope you will enjoy it, take care and always be safe in these turbulent times. So maybe a little bit about myself first, in case you don't know that. I happened to be at the announcement meeting in 2000. I wrote some specifications in 2005. I mean, there's not really specifications, there's not like not really like speculations. It's somewhere in between. Anyway, specifications I call them nowadays. I got involved again in 2012, initially for documentation only. I became a core developer from 2013 onwards. I've been writing a weekly blog from 2015 onwards. And I've become a Iraco Steering Council member. So what is this presentation about? Well, it's important to know about the past to be able to make new mistakes in the future. This presentation shows how you can actually research the past, keep up to date on current developments, and how you can prepare your production code for the future and be liked by your sysadmins and guard against issues with dependencies. And we'll also throw in a little bit about how the Iraco ecosystem actually works. So, if you're interested in history, so could you go for some deep spelunking? I guess you could. That's where the original design documents, the original design documents are basically located. It's a lot of text and people have been working on it for many years, but it's basically nowadays only of historical value. In many cases, it gives you a background on how ideas about certain features were formed over time. It can still be used as a source of ideas, but it should not be considered authoritative because the test suite nowadays is the authoritative thing. Anything that any implementation of the Iraco programming language that actually can run the test suite can be considered a Iraco implementation. Now, over the years, people have been spreading the word and have been writing blog posts, and they've been posted on many, often now defunct websites. This is a pity for several reasons. I guess the most is that they are gone, but they also mention Perl 6 rather than Iraco. So that's why I started the CCR project, Collect, Conserve, Remaster project, to attempt to preserve and update all these blog posts. It basically consists of three phases. Collect, basically finding the URLs of blog posts. Conserve, creating local copies, so we actually have a copy of the blog post should the original URL become unavailable. And a process of Iracoification of the blog post for prosperity. And the result of this should always be that we get better searchability for the Iraco programming language on the interwebs. So this is the repository where all these things have been kept so far. But there's not all of it in it yet, and that basically still needs a lot of work. So you can help the CCR project if you want to. I'm personally looking forward to any people taking the CCR to create a very nice website with the best of Iraco. But you can also help with collecting URLs or help conserving URLs, or even better, help remastering blog posts. In any case, any help that you that will be offered by you will be appreciated very much. And I'm looking forward to actually see all of these very nice blog posts by, for instance, Sofik CNET in their new forum, somewhere published in a very nice layout and good searchability. So let's go back a little bit. If you really want to research stuff about Iraco, you probably want to also find out more about the actual development of Iraco. And for that, I've created a website that actually contains all of the historic IRC logs and current logs. Because basically, since the first implementation of Iraco from 2005 onwards, most of the communication has been on IRC. Before that, it was mostly on the mailing list, but from 2005 onwards, it has been mostly on IRC. And therefore, the IRC logs are a good place for information about how things came to be. It provides a historical record of the conversations that were had by the RACO community, and it also provides live updates on all current RACO IRC channels. If you really are interested in the raw form, you can actually see the raw logs if you want to. They are actually saved in a GitHub repository, which is updated daily, and they are exposed by the web server that is completely written in RACO. And that web server provides search, filter, and gist capabilities with infinite up and down scroll. And of course, all of this is completely open source. The repo where the actual logs are kept is here. But have a look at the search options that you get on the web server. So on the left-hand side, you can open up a search window. And the search window, when you're browsing a channel, you can actually look for words, either as words or strings or at the start of a message. Results are by default presented from the end, with the most recent last, unless you selected old at first. So if you're really interested in historic things, then you select old at first. If you are interested in recent stuff about something that you're looking for, then you don't check that. You can limit your searches to certain nicks and optionally include their aliases, like the underscore after it. And you can actually select to search for both text as well as control messages, such as people joining and leaving a channel. Or basically, you can select for either control messages or text messages. And finally, you can actually limit your search to a given period. When you have the result of a search, you can actually limit this by filtering them further. And this is done actually on the client side, so in your browser. You can select to see only messages by with a certain text string in it, or not have a certain string in it, or only select those messages that only are from certain nicks, or not written by certain nicks. By default, the system messages are not shown. You can select to actually show them. By default, you will get to see the any commit messages, but you can select to not see them. And by default, you can actually see all Camellia output, and you can select to not see that. So let's take this for a spin, hey? So let's have a look at, let's see where Larry Wall, aka Tim Toady on the channel, said something for the first time on the Pearl 6 channel. So we select oldest first. You make sure that we enter Tim Toady there in the next field, and we press enter. And we get a result. So you could see that at the 22nd of February, Tim Toady said something for the first time on channel. Now, with the little ellipsis on the right-hand side, you can actually bring up a pull-down with options. And one of the options is actually show on day. Basically, it will take that message and show it to you on the day it was made in a day view rather than a search result. If you do that, you get something like this. Here you can see other people after Tim Toady said something for the first time, and people are welcoming it, and etc. etc. So that's all nice, but actually, this was not the first thing that Tim Toady actually, or I should say Larry Wall, actually said on the channel. If you go on a little more spelunking, you will see that actually, if you show the system messages as well, and basically limit the messages to the nick Larry and Audrey T, you will find that actually Larry already joined 10 minutes earlier as Larry, but apparently that was already registered by somebody else. So for about a minute, Larry Wall was known as L Wall on the channel, but then changed it to Tim Toady, and it was Audrey Tang that at the time that actually registered that nick for Larry Wall, and so that's how Tim Toady came to be on the channel. When you're browsing a channel, you can actually have another few options there. In the browse pull down, you can select whether you want to see what is happening live on the channel. Of course, the channel should still exist, so anything on the Pulse 6 channel, you won't have a live button there. You can show all the messages of the day so far. Of course, this is only for a live channel, channels that are still in operation. You can select a random date. I mean, if you really want to browse and want to be shown around the place, you can use that. You can also see the raw log of the messages. This is mostly for debugging, but if you really want to go in there, you can do that. And there's also an overview for all the years, months and days in which there were messages on this channel. So this is how you can actually use this Logs web server. And yeah, it's a very nice thing, and it has been used already by quite a lot of people so far. But enough about this. This should probably be a presentation all on its own. So let's go on to the next part. And this is about preparing production code in Raku. Any production environment depends heavily on the foundation on which it is built. And historically, work on a foundation has been a cause of many failures in production environments. Recently, there was a thing about Leftpad, a very simple library that the author removed from an ecosystem, and all of a sudden a lot of things didn't work anymore. And that is something that we don't want in Raku, so we actually have ways of getting around that. So in Raku, you can cement your foundation to the ground so that you don't have to worry about work on the foundation of your production code. Before we go on a little bit about that, is basically I would like to go into the use of uselib, aka minus I, or setting the RakuLib environment variable. This should not be used in a production environment, obviously, unless you really understand what you're doing, because it basically defeats any versioning checks that might be specified with use statements. And that is probably not what you want. Specifying directories in which Raku modules live is really a development and testing tool only. So if you want, if you are serious about your production code, you should create a meta file for it and basically install it with zev install dot in that directory. And that will ensure that your code will continue to work and refer to the right things. So what does it actually mean if we say use foo? Well, that basically means find any code in install code in the install base identified by foo. Select the one with the highest version number. Make sure it is compiled or pre-compiled. Load the bytecode, run its main line, and import its exported symbols into the current lexical scope. That's basically what it is, but that is vulnerable to any updates. If anybody would update the module foo on your system, then it would start using a different version number on the next startup. And that is probably not what you want. It may be what you want, but then you probably need to change your dependencies. So what does it mean if I actually limit my module selection to a specific version? So you can do that by specifying the colon ver and then specifying the version in your use statement. It limits acceptable code to a specific version, but any code using the same name but by a different author could be installed and break your production code. Because loading would fail because of the conflict. There would be two versions of the same module with the same version number, one by author A and one by author B. So it is not likely that this happens. It would probably indicate a deliberate breaking attempt, but nonetheless, it would break your production code, and you don't want that. So what does that mean? Basically, you can specify that you want to have a module by a certain author. The author is recognized by a indicator of the ecosystem in which it lives. That could be either CPAN or GitHub or Ceph, and the name of the author that is being used to upload modules to those systems. So you fix that by making sure that you got your module from this particular author. But it does not limit the version, so you will it will still select the one with the highest version number, so it's still vulnerable to changes. You can also specify the API that a module should have. So you want a module with that API, but that would also select the highest version regardless of author with a given API value. So also vulnerable to changes. So if you want to be really strict, you can specify the version, the author, and the API version. That will be the safest way to specify dependency. Not only is the version fixed, the author and the API of the module as well. But it is a lot of typing, and it's not that convenient. So there's another way of doing that, and basically just specify the version and the author. It's basically the best trade-off that you can do. The version and the author are fixed. If the module comes from CPAN, you are actually sure that this is the correct version, because you cannot have two modules with the same version and the same author on CPAN. On Zeph, it is technically still possible to do that, but we're thinking about not allowing that, but yeah, that's not the case yet. Generally, modules are not released with identical version, but a different API value. So this way it is actually recommended to be used for external dependencies, but also for internal dependencies, because you really, as a developer, should channel your inner sysadmin. Think about how flexible you would like to be and how you will make sure that all of your code uses the version of dependencies it was made to work with. I mean, future versions of Raku may make this easier and more automatic, but we're not there yet, and so it is important for you to understand how this works to prevent any unpleasant surprises in production. So this was a lot about the use statement and code externally. So where does this code come from? Well, you'd say the Raku ecosystem, of course. So what is the Raku ecosystem? Well, nowadays it is actually mostly visible in the raku.land site. It's a very nice site written in Raku, all open source, that allows you to actually browse and search for modules in the Raku ecosystem. It is built with Raku. It is a newer version of the older modules.raku.org website, which was specifically not built with Raku. And it is completely open source. So that would be the recommended place for looking for modules that you could use in your programs. But now the bad news, or the bad news, the surprising news maybe, is that there is no ecosystem in Raku. There is no ecosystem? Well, technically Raku expects a $star repo dynamic variable object. Sorry, let's rephrase that. Raku expects the $star repo dynamic variable to contain an object that is the first of a chain that knows what to do. By default, this is a compunit repository installation object provided by Raku. Now that is a very long name, so we usually shorten that to cur installation. It has an install method that knows how to install a module. It has a candidates method that knows how to look up a use target. And it has a load method that knows how to import and run a candidate. Because in Raku, everything is pluggable. Well, almost, but yeah. You could say everything is pluggable. You can replace that $star repo dynamic variable by anything you want, as long as it provides the expected interface. And one such plugin is provided by Raku itself. It's the compunit repository file system, aka cur file system module. And you activate that with -i or uselib, or by setting the Rakulib environment variable. So what happens if you are doing a using -i foo? You actually replace the $star repo object with a cur file system object. That object will refer any queries to the object previously in $star repo if it cannot satisfy searching for a use target itself, the original cur installation object. And like the other, it has an installation method that dies. But this one dies because you cannot install modules with -i or uselib. It has a candidate method that knows how to look up a use target, disregarding any specification of version or authority or API. And it has a load method that knows how to import and run a candidate. But if there is no ecosystem, you can still install with Ceph, right? Indeed, you can. Ceph is a versatile interface for selecting and managing distributions for installation. But Ceph does not install modules itself. It selects, creates a proper cur installation object, calls install on it with the correct parameters, and that actually installs the module. It is not part of the Raku core, although it is packaged often along with Rakudo. So, okay, Ceph is an interface for selecting and managing distributions, but where does Ceph actually look up these distributions? Well, basically where you tell it to, but generally people don't tell Ceph where to look, so it will look for you at three content storage locations. It will look at the newest Ceph system, also referred to as the FES system. It will look at CPAN, and it will look at the original Git system for the ecosystem, basically. So how do these systems differ? And what are these systems anyway? The content storage location, what is that? Okay, let's have a look at this then. The original Git system basically consists of one file on GitHub that consists of a list of URLs. And each line contains the URL of a meta information of a distribution, typically a meta6.json file. And that meta information contains, among many other things, the URL of the actual distribution tar file. Every hour, all meta URLs are checked and combined into a single module list containing the meta information of all modules and stored on GitHub. And that file is downloaded and cached locally by Ceph to search. So how does this work for the modules on CPAN? Well, the modules on CPAN each live in a PRL6 subdirectory for each author. Each uploaded Raku module has a meta file in that directory. And each uploaded Raku module actually has the distribution tar file in the same directory, and it cannot be changed. Every hour, all PRL6 directories of CPAN authors are checked, and all available meta files are downloaded and combined into a single module list and stored on GitHub. And that file is then downloaded and cached locally by Ceph to search. So how does that work with the new Ceph ecosystem? Well, that's pretty easy there. You upload to the Ceph ecosystem with the FES application, and it updates its module list immediately. This file is downloaded, cached locally by Ceph to search. That's pretty easy and pretty quick. So let's have a little graphical representation of this. So let's assume you are an author who creates a module. You can select to which content storage you would like to have your module live in. That could be P6C, that could be CPAN, and it could be FES. If you upload to FES, it's immediately available. If you upload to P6C, it's available after about an hour. And if you upload to CPAN, it's also available after about an hour. Then anybody in the world running Ceph, Ceph will pull these when they are considered stale. It will, when you ask it to install a module, it will basically call the compunit repository installation object with the correct parameters, and voila, it's available in Raku. That's how it basically works. Now, what are the pros and cons of each of these systems? Well, each storage system that is used by Ceph has its advantages and disadvantages. And you could consider in some respects that each storage system reflects the choices that were made at some time during the development of the Raku programming language. So what are the pros of the original system? It was very easy to implement. Authors didn't need to sign up for anything. Just needed the location to make the meta and the distribution file available for download. So what are the cons for this system? Well, it's not clear who is responsible for the integrity of a module. You can impersonate any author, there are no upload checks. You can have different versions even if the version value is the same. So if you have a module by a certain version, you're not exactly 100% sure that they are always the same. And it takes about up to an hour to become visible to Zeph, which can cause issues with continuous integration testing. And it's difficult to install versions other than the most recent. And some modules don't actually have any versioning at all. And modules can disappear without notice, thus potentially breaking production code. So what are the pros of CPAN? Well, you have, if you're using something like AppMI6 to develop your models in, it has integrated upload support. The author is verified on upload of a module. The version of the module is checked on upload, and immutability is guaranteed. But the cons are you need a POS login if you don't have one, which nowadays can be a little troublesome because it needs manual intervention, and there aren't that many people that do that nowadays anymore. It's not clear who is responsible for the integrity of a module. The authority is not checked. And it takes up to an hour to become possibly visible to Zeph, which can cause issues with CI testing. On the CI testing, basically imagine that you have a module A that depends on module B. And you need to update both. So you upload module B, and then you have to wait an hour before you can upload module A, because your continuous integration testing wouldn't be able to see your new version of module A that B needs in its testing. So that's really the problem. And of course, modules can disappear without notice from CPAN as well. So what are the pros of Zeph, or Fez, depending on how you look at it? It also has integrated upload support with AppMI6 since recently. The author is verified on upload of a module. The authority and the version of the module are checked on upload. And the module becomes installable immediately, well, within seconds. And the module cannot be removed. The cons of Zeph: you need to apply for a Fez login, but fortunately that's automated with an email reply. And the system is a black box that lives in the cloud somewhere somehow. So yeah, it's there, we hope. The general cons of any of these backends is that they can become temporarily or permanently unavailable. If a module disappears, there's no easy way to install it if your production code needs it. So that's why I decided to actually create the Raku Ecosystem Archive. It attempts to keep a copy of each module ever available and exposes its contents as a GitHub repository to allow for easy availability and change tracking. So it exposes its meta for applications as Zeph, and we currently have about 7,500 identities already in this system. So graphically, we have the RIA here that does an hourly pull, and that makes it potentially available to Zeph. But Zeph actually doesn't know about the RIA by default yet. So for that, we have something called Zeph configuration. Zeph configuration provides an API to the config of Zeph and a command line interface for ease of use for common actions. So if you do a Zeph install of this module, and then you can do a Zeph-configure enable RIA, and you're set. Your production code can now install any module that was ever released, even if it no longer lives in the active ecosystem. So there we got a fine arrow there. Further considerations are you can Zeph searching for the P6C and CPAN basically becomes rather unnecessary now because there's an hourly delay in P6C and CPAN as well as there is in the RIA. So the RIA already provides all of those. If you agree with that assessment, you can, for instance, say Zeph configure disable P6C and Zeph disable CPAN. And that graphically shows like this. Those two arrows disappear. And Zeph only has two places to look for your modules. So both the internal as well as external elements of the Raku programming language are now being preserved. This is good for a 100-year programming language. because it should be able to support your ancient code. All of these non-core elements are now ready for the next 80 plus years, I think. But now it's up to the core to actually refine its support for different language levels. So that's something that will happen in this year. And I'm personally looking forward to that. Okay, so here we are at the end. Again, links of the mentioned projects, the designs, where you can do your spelunking, the CCR, the logs browsing, Rakuland, the Rhea modules, and other useful links, Raku.org, our main site, the docs, documentation. If you have any questions about Raku, you can either do them on Stack Overflow or on Reddit, or you can put them on the channel, or actually you can also put it on Twitter. There will be people looking for it. If you're really in favor of using a integrated editor for your programming, there's the Comma that you can have a look at. And if you're interested in creating interactive services, then Cross Services is something that you should also have a look at. And if you want to stay up to date, there's also the Rakudo Weekly News that brings information about all of the stuff that happens in the Raku world. So for this, for the projects that I actually mentioned in this presentation, 23 modules were created. Some of them are very specific. Some of them actually could be more generally handy, like map match, for instance, or a highlighter, or etc. Have a look at them. You might be surprised how handy they can be. So I guess this puts us at the end. Thank you for being with me so far. I'll be ready to respond to any questions for the remaining minutes that we actually have. I'll see you there. But remember, the future is here, and thank you for watching so far. Okay, I guess you can hear me now. Any questions?